genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Oh, then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turning now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Now, remember, every show has a theme. Today's theme is values. Both of our guests are challenging us to consider our values. In the first half hour, we looked at business values. In this next half hour, we're going to look at our hypocritical value towards the animal kingdom. Now, how rational are we in our relationships with animals? Let me give you a simple example. A puppy. A puppy, after all, is a family member if you live in Kansas. It's a pariah if you live in Kenya, and it's lunch if you live in Korea. Our next guest is an animal behavioralist and one of the world's foremost authorities on human-animal relations. He shows us how whimsical our attitudes can be. Now, this is an emotionally charged issue. If you feel strongly you want to join the conversation, call us at 639-0008. Hal Herzog has been investigating the complex psychology of our interactions with other species for more than two decades. He's particularly interested in how humans negotiate real-world ethical dilemmas, and he has studied animal activists, cockfighters, veterinary students, animal researchers, even ex-vegetarians. An award-winning teacher and researcher, he's written more than 100 articles and books, too many to list here. His work's been covered by Newsweek, National Public Radio, Scientific America, USA Today, and the list goes on and on and on. He's the author of Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat: Why It's Hard to Think Straight About Animals. Hal Herzog is a professor of psychology at Western Carolina University. He lives in the Smoky Mountains with his wife, Mary Jean, and their cat, Telly. Welcome to the show. How are you today, Hal?
I'm doing great, Billy. How are you?
Well, I'm doing fantastic. Welcome to the show. This is such a fun topic because we really are hypocrites when it comes to the animal kingdom and our place in the world. So let's start with the example that I gave in the introduction, okay? Something as simple as a puppy. Here in the United States, we consider a puppy a pet. In Australia, they consider it a work animal. In Kenya, it's a pariah. And in Korea, it's lunch. So how can the same animal be perceived so differently across so many different cultures?
That's a great point. And what it shows is that our attitudes towards animals are really a complicated mix of biology and culture. For example, we love puppies in part because they have these great big eyes, and they remind us of human infants, and our brain is wired. We have this maternal-paternal instinct that makes us go for them for that reason. But on the other hand, culture can override that. And so, for example, certain religions see dogs as pariahs, and other religions value them very highly. Whether you keep one as a pet or whether you despise it, in part depending on, for example, your religious beliefs even.
Okay. Well, I've got to ask you, since you mentioned about anthropomorphizing animals, how much does Walt Disney and the other cartoons anthropomorphizing the animals really influence our Western outlook towards animals?
Oh, tremendously, tremendously. And so, for example, the good example is the movie Bambi.
Right.
Bambi changed, in part, America's attitudes towards hunting. And one of the things that Walt Disney did is that he actually had his animators make Bambi's eyes bigger and make Bambi more infantile, because the original sketches for Bambi, they didn't look baby enough alike.
Mm.
Weren't cute enough. And what Walt Disney wanted to do was to sort of bring up that cute response that we're all prone to, and really changed a lot of Americans' attitudes about hunting. Attitudes towards hunting went down after Bambi came out.
So you're saying that Walt Disney was one of this country's first animal activists?
In a sense, yeah.
That's breaking news right here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain.
I'm not sure I'd go quite that far, but yeah, he had a big influence on how we perceived. I think he probably perceived how we changed how we perceive mice too.
Absolutely, he did. And ducks and dogs and all kinds of animals as
That's
well. We're talking
right,
to
yeah.
Hal, we're talking to Hal Herzog, everybody, author of the book Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat. We're talking about our crazy mixed up views towards the animal kingdom. I mean, there are so many examples. Let me give you just another one right here from Ventura County, Hal, if I can.
Okay.
We've got members of the 4-H Club right now that are raising animals for show. They care for them. You know, I'd even say they go so far as to love these animals. They enter them into the Ventura County Fair every summer. And then afterwards, win or lose, these animals are sold and slaughtered. I mean, what does that tell us about human perception towards animals, particularly farm animals?
Well, I think that's the bottom line. To me, the ultimate conflict over animals has to do with slaughtering and eating them. And on the one hand, we love animals. On the other hand, most people, vast majority of people, whether they admit it or not, love to eat them as well. I recently talked to a woman who told me that when she was in 4-H, they had to raise a chicken. And what I couldn't believe was they actually had to kill the chicken themselves.
Mm.
And I was absolutely shocked by that. That seems to me cruel for a child. But on the other hand, that's the way things were when we're a more agrarian culture, and we've gotten away from that now. We've gotten away from the fact that meat is made of animals in many ways.
Sure, sure. We're talking to Hal Herzog, everybody. Hal, I got to say, I love animals. I particularly love them medium rare, so I'm very much conflicted by this. But we have moved away from an agrarian society. I mean, when I'm foraging for food down the aisles of my grocery store, I'm really not thinking about how those animals were raised and killed. In fact, modern food manufacturing is a cruel business. If you look at documentaries such as Food Incorporated, most cows and chickens are killed cruelly and painfully. You know, we think little about how we hunt for how we're hunting for these animals when we're going down the aisles of the supermarket, like I say. How anesthetized about how our food is raised and slaughtered have we become in this modern society that we've got?
We've become very anesthetized, and the food industry has actually made that easier and easier. For example, when I was younger, I was a kid, my mother would go to the store, and if she went to buy a chicken, it came back in the form of a carcass.
Hmm.
So it had wings, and I don't remember if it had feet, but it had legs and stuff like that, and she would have to cut it up. On the other hand, now what happens is the vast majority of chicken in this country is consumed in the form of weird things like chicken tenders or slices of breast meat that is so disembodied you don't even have a bone in it. So it's really easier to pretend that that piece of flesh that you're eating was not an animal. In fact, one of the really surprising things that I found while writing this book was the fact that most people that say that they're vegetarians actually eat meat, usually in the form of chicken or fish.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, very interesting. Now, one of the other interesting statistics, Hal, that you quote in the book is something like 60% of us that are surveyed believe that animals deserve to live, and yet we raise animals for food. I mean, how do we as a society reconcile that complete disparity?
That's a great point. In fact, I've even done some research showing that among the people that L.A. Times did a survey at one point, and they asked people how they respond to this question, and the question was, or the statement, animals are just like people in all important ways. And they found that most of the people that, they found that 47% of people agreed with that. Well, I didn't believe that. And so I replicated that with college students, and I found exactly the same thing. The thing that I found also was that of that 47% of college students that said the animals were just like people, 50% believed in animal research, and over 90% ate these animals that they thought were just like people in all important ways. And we have this cultural schizophrenia, and I think the way most people handle it is simply by not thinking about it. And what I'm hoping my book does is actually sort of tweaking people into saying, hey, these are complicated questions, and it helps to really think about them a little more deeply than to just sort of not bother.
Well, it absolutely does. We're talking to Hal Herzog, everybody, author of the book Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's Hard to Think Straight About Animals. Now, just continuing on with this whole disembodied from our food sort of thinking that we were talking about, in fairness, there's a growing concern about food processing leading to cage-free chickens, humanely killed meats, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Why do you think this movement's catching on? What impacts will it have, if any, towards how we view our relationship with animals?
Well, I think the interesting thing about it is that in some ways these movements have made it easier to eat meat. So, for example, I'll take me, for example. I'm very aware of the horrors of factory farming. I'm very aware of the horrors of industrial chicken raising in particular. I wrote about them. So what I do is I can go to even my store, which is a rural, you know, little small town in my local grocery store, and I can buy chicken that's labeled cage-free. I can buy chicken that is cruelty-free, hormone-free, organic, and all that stuff. And that sort of enables me to perhaps delude myself, as it were, into thinking that, okay, it's okay for me to eat meat. So in a way, the animal protection movement has made meat in some ways more palatable. And that might be one reason why we now eat three times as many animals in the United States as we did when Peter Singer wrote Animal Liberation in 1975.
Wait, run that statistic by me again, how we eat three times as many different species of animals than in 1975?
No, not different species of animals, different animals. In 1975, when Peter Singer wrote Animal Liberation, started the animal liberation movement, the average American ate about 170 pounds of meat, and we killed about 3 billion creatures a year. Now we eat about 240 pounds of meat per person, and we kill over 10 billion animals a year. So the fact of the matter is, the efforts of the animal liberation movement to moralize meat has been a total failure.
How very interesting. We're talking to Hal Herzog, everybody. So how did we decide as a species of people, humans, to differentiate between animals that we raise for food and those we raise to domesticate for pets?
Oh, boy, that's a good one, and we really don't know completely the answer to that. And probably at one point they were sort of confused. It's quite likely that the first animal that we domesticated, which was the dog, probably did double duty as food and pet for quite a number of years. That dogs were in part raised to be what some people called the walking larder. You could keep one around, and when times got hard and you needed something to eat, you could eat a puppy. It's relatively recent we had this complete distinction between the animals we eat and the animals that we keep as pets.
It is an interesting dilemma. I'm just going to go ahead and continue down this path, because don't we really, for our brains, don't we need a high degree of protein? And let's face it, the kinds of protein that we get from animal meats is the best type of protein that we get to support our brains. So as survival of the species, doesn't it make sense that we're just going to eat everything in our path?
Not anymore. That's for sure. That was the case. That was the case, I think, in the when we in the evolutionary path from a creature that was like a chimpanzee to us. And it's very likely that the increased carnivory that we saw amongst apes actually resulted in the big brain. But that was then, and this is now. And the argument that we eat, it's okay to eat meat because it's natural, doesn't hold a whole lot of water. I do eat meat, but on the other hand, I think it's pretty hard to justify at least the amount of meat that we do based on the idea that it's natural.
Oh, very interesting. Well, I just want to take this one step further. We're talking to Hal Herzog, everybody. And Hal, how did we select the animals that we choose for food? And let me just give you some examples. I mean, the pig. You know, the pig has a large brain. It's a very intelligent animal. It can be easily domesticated and so forth. We choose the pig for slaughter to be pork. And yet we protect the dolphin, which also has a large brain. But we choose to hunt the whale, which is a mammal. It's a large brain mammal. We choose to hunt that for both food and oil. Although the United States has stopped hunting whales, still other countries in the world do. So, I mean, how do we make these distinctions?
That's a really great point. And in part, it's cultural tradition, and it seems almost arbitrary. There's some anthropologists that sort of come up with post hoc reasoning. So, for example, they'll say in India that they don't kill pigs because they're used for milk and work, and even manure is used for essentially for firewood. But on the other hand, in Pakistan, right next door, they do eat pigs. So I'm not sure that I buy these sort of ecological arguments. I think in part it's a matter of tradition. For example, I was recently in a Chinese restaurant, and I saw jellyfish on the menu. And I was writing the book, and I had a list of the foods that I would never eat, and I had jellyfish on that list. And
really?
It was on the menu, and I had to decide whether to eat it or not. And I actually did. I actually ordered the jellyfish and ate jellyfish. And so how can jellyfish be a delicacy in some cultures and be absolutely horrifying in another culture? And again, in part of that, I think that's completely arbitrary.
Well, we're talking to Hal Herzog, everybody. Hal, we're going to have to break here for some commercial messages just to pay some bills. But I want you to think about that, since you brought up the whole issue of jellyfish. When you watch shows like Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmer, you quickly learn that protein is protein. Different societies eat different foods based on what's available. Some people eat grubs and guinea pigs and sea slugs and, in your case, jellyfish. And so don't answer this now, but how much of our relationship with animals is based on what we find around us? Don't answer that now. Answer it when we come back after this short break.
And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back, everybody, to KKZZ AM 1400. We're Positive Talk Radio for Ventura County. I'm Bill Frank. You're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're on every day, 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock here on KKZZ. Our guest today is Hal Herzog. Our theme for the show is values. And what we're debating and batting back and forth is our value relationship with animals, the animal kingdom that's out there. Hal has written a book, Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, How It's Hard, Why It's Hard to Think Straight About Animals. And before we went to break, you were sharing your experience, Hal, of eating jellyfish. And I brought up the question, if you watch shows on the Food Network like Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmer, you quickly learn that protein is protein. People in other parts of the world eat all different kinds of things, grubs, guinea pigs, sea slugs, jellyfish, shark fin, whatever it might be. How much of our relationship with animals is based on what we find around us and what we choose to eat?
Well, it, a tremendous amount is based on that, but even that can change. And the example that I use in my book is in Nepal. There's a village in Nepal that an anthropologist studied called the Tharu. And in that village, when he was there, they had water buffalo around. They used them for work and them for, you know, thought of them as pets and workers, things like that. And they would never eat them. Well, 10 years later, he went back, and he was served buffalo meat, and he couldn't. And it was amazing because it was seen absolutely disgusting to eat one before, like eating your family dog. And they completely changed in 10 years. And what had happened was that the caste system had broken down, and they were exposed to different parts of Nepalese culture where people did eat buffalo. So even one of the things that surprised me in my studies of human-animal interactions is the tremendous role that culture has and how rapidly these attitudes can actually change.
Now, 10 years is no time at all to change an attitude that deeply rooted. So,
yeah.
Well, let's get away from food for just a minute, if we can. And I want to change the subject completely and take a look at why some animals are prized, like dogs and horses, and other animals are despised, things like snakes.
Well, I think, once again, it's a mix of nature and nurture. Let's compare dogs and snakes, actually.
Okay.
In fact, there's researchers in Southern California that have done a lot of research on this stuff. We seem to have an instinctive fear of snakes.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes back to, the Stone Age, and even today in Africa and Asia, many thousands of people are killed by snakes each year, but they're certainly not in the United States. The animal which is by far most likely to injure or seriously hurt or even kill you is none other than the dog.
Sure.
So you're 100 times more likely to be seriously injured by a dog than you are a snake. But yet, snakes are the most feared. You ask people, what the animals are phobic about, snakes are the ones that come to the fore tremendously.
Well, I agree. I mean, I'm one of those people. I admit it. I don't like snakes. There's no logical reason for it. But, and I don't encounter snakes on a day-to-day basis either. But I kind of associated that from an early age. I was told the story of Adam and Eve from the Bible. A snake is evil and so forth. You're saying it's deeper than that. It's deeper than that part of my culture. It is really more biologically, inherently, we are fearful of snakes?
I think it's a combination. There's actually there's a fight brewing over that right now amongst comparative psychologists and evolutionary psychologists. But I think the evidence is overwhelming that we either have a instinct to avoid snakes, or at the very least, we have a predilection to learn to fear them. So it's easier to learn to fear snakes than it is to learn to fear dogs.
Interesting. So it's easier. Okay, I get that. Now, why are some animals more revered than others? Why are horses more revered than, say, wombats? Bad example, because there aren't too many wombats. But why one more than another?
Well, I think again, partially. Let's look at baby fur seals, baby harp seals.
Okay.
Well, everybody gets in a twit about baby harp seals. You see these pictures of them, smashed on the Canadian ice floes. Well, it's part because they remind so much of human infants, those great big eyes that look like pools. And you compare that to a really endangered animal, the giant Chinese salamander, which is the world's largest amphibian, and which is highly endangered and on the verge of going extinct. But it's a 6-foot, 100-pound hunk of slime, brown slime with little beady eyes. So it's really easy to get people to be revered over an animal like that. Now, horses are special, and I'm not a horse expert, so I probably shouldn't say too much about that. But the horse relationship goes back a long way, and horses have generally been objects that we've been intimately connected with in the sense of being tools, objects that we use. So, but again, even horses in France, horse meat is eaten frequently.
True, very true. We're talking to Hal Herzog, everybody, author of the book Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's Hard to Think Straight About Animals. And I'm going to turn to a really ugly side of our relationship with animals and rip something from the headlines. Michael Vick was sent to jail for fighting dogs. Now, here's a man who clearly didn't need the money that he got from the dog fighting and everything else. Dogs are just one of the animals that were drawn towards fighting. What's our fascination with dog fighting, cock fighting, bull fighting, mongoose on cobra fighting, betta fish fighting? I mean, we've got all of these different fighting combinations. What is our predilection towards that?
This is seen in virtually every culture, and you point at all these different types of fighting. And so, for example, in China right now, little kids go around and they will match crickets against each other. Cricket fighting is big. My guess is this is sort of it's always men that are doing most of the fighting, and so my guess is this is part of general competition that men have. And you know, my rooster's bigger than your rooster, sort of like my dad's tougher than your dad.
Right.
And part of this is culture. I don't know much about dog fighters. I've never studied dog fighters. But I have studied cockfighters, and so I know a lot about that culture. And the most interesting thing about that culture that I found, and this was Southern Appalachian cockfighters that I studied, and it's been a long time, it's been 30 years since I've done that, was that at that time, the rooster fighters that I was hanging out with, which were my neighbors, the thing that was surprising about them was how normal they were in every aspect of their lives. They were church people, they voted conservative, they had families, they had middle-class jobs, except they had this one thing. Saturday night, they'd go fight chickens to the death and bet on it.
And that is illegal in your part of the world, isn't it?
It's everywhere in the United States now, but it was even illegal then. But law didn't take it all that seriously back in the 70s when I was doing this. But the interesting thing to me is when I actually talked with them about how they justified this, I realized that their justification for fighting roosters was not all that much different than my justification for eating them. Furthermore, their chickens were treated a whole lot better than the chickens that I was eating when I went down to McDonald's.
Well, that is an interesting point, Hal, because we had one of this country's leading authorities on bullfighting a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about bullfighting when that bull leapt into the stands in Spain.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
You remember that incident?
Yeah.
And we were talking about bullfighting at that time, and he made the point that these bulls are treated like royalty up until the time that they go into the bull ring do battle with the matador.
That's exactly the same with gamecocks, and I guarantee you or any reader, any listener that you have, if you have come back in the next life as a chicken and you have a choice between a game rooster and a McDonald's chicken, you will take the gamecock. They have a whole lot better life and a longer life than a factory farm broiler.
Very, very true. We're talking to Hal Herzog, everybody. Hal, let's continue on this line of thinking, though, because one of the arguments that you hear all the time is that male dogs, cocks, betta fish, they naturally fight each other in the wild. So they're sort of willing participants in a fight if left to their own devices. What do you say to the logic that says when the agents are willing, there can be no cruelty?
Yeah, I completely disagree with that. There's a wonderful quote. If you remember the movie The African Queen,
yes.
There's a wonderful quote. At one point, Katharine Hepburn looks at who was it?
Humphrey Bogart
and Mr. McNutt, and she says, "Nature, Mr. McNutt, is what we are here to overcome." And that's the difference between us and a chimpanzee. Chimpanzee has no guilt at all about ripping the arm off a live colobus monkey and eating it, or disemboweling it while it's alive and eating it. But we're different from monkeys, and we have a moral burden. So simply because something is natural does not make it right. There's lots of things that are natural that are lousy. And I don't buy the naturalistic, philosophers call the naturalistic fallacy at all.
Okay, fair enough. We're talking to Hal Herzog. Hal, then where do you fall on institutions such as zoos and circuses, where we cage animals for display to in the guise of teaching people about nature and everything else?
Let me talk about circuses first. I've actually studied circus animal trainers, but I didn't put anything about it in my book. And the reason was that after interviewing dozens of circus animal trainers and then going and interviewing them on their home grounds in Florida, I still didn't understand them enough to write about them. And I've got a PhD in animal behavior, so I know a lot about animal behavior. These guys knew so much more about animal behavior than I did or any ethologist did. And they love their animals. But yet, when you think about an elephant or tigers or something like that, and spending their lives in captivity in a cage for 7 minutes in a ring, and that's usually what the average animal act is 7 minutes, I cannot justify that anymore. And I really changed my mind about that. I really like the animal circus animal trainers I met.
Mm-hmm.
I was just fascinated by them. I would love to study them enough that I could describe their lives, but it would take really joining the circus for a year to do it. but they're an anachronism in the modern world, and I just can't justify that anymore.
All right, fair enough. We're talking to Hal Herzog, everybody. Hal, we've only got about a minute left, and in that minute I want to ask you this question. You write that humans and only humans love pets, yet I've seen examples of monkeys bonding with, even raising dogs, even dogs and cats bonding together. Clearly, these animals get some form of gratification from bonding. So explain the difference between, you know, a human bonding with a pet where we keep it as an animal around the house and these animals bonding with each other that you see on, you know, strangest home videos, that kind of thing.
Yeah, what you see those all the time. Almost always, they're usually the animals are in some sort of captive situation, or a zoo or a game park or something like that, or they're temporary where the animals are playing for a couple of minutes or something like that. There's only one example that I know of pet keeping, but I would consider pet keeping a long-term association between different species in the wild, and that was a recent case that occurred in Brazil where one species of monkey actually adopted the baby of another species of monkey and then raised it for 14 months. Other than that, it's shocking that you never see pet keeping in chimpanzees in the wild. It's never been described. Chimpanzees will occasionally adopt a baby animal, but they usually kill it within 15 or 20 minutes, and the only thing they don't do is eat it.
Wow. All right. That's very interesting. Hal, we're out of time, unfortunately. We've been talking to Hal Herzog, author of the book Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's Hard to Think Straight About Animals. Hal, thank you so much for being our guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain.
It's been great. I've really enjoyed it.
We'll talk to you down the road.